This is XTP Media.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson and welcome to episode 40 of Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. And joining me in the studio today are my very good friends. And first of all, Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine, Tim Robinson. Tim, how are you?
I'm very well, Peter. Hello, everybody.
Sadly, Gareth Stringer can't be with us today. He's not very well, so our very best wishes for a speedy recovery go to Gareth. But Gareth is now the Executive Editor at Global Aviation Resource, so in his absence, a very well-deserved promotion. And we have a special guest host with us today. Tony Blackman has spent his life in the aircraft industry as a test pilot, an avionics specialist, as well as on the board of the UK Civil Aviation Authority. He's an author of both non-fiction and fiction books and is, of course, the author behind the great Test Pilot and V-Bomber Boy books on the Victor, Valiant and Vulcan. Tony, welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm really thrilled to be here. I'm looking forward to the show. It's a new experience for me and I'm sure I'm going to enjoy it, even if you don't.
Well, we're very excited to have you here. Your CV runs much longer than the few lines I gave you there, so we're very excited to get to talk to you later. But do join us on any topics as we go through the news and through the other areas. And welcome to the team.
Thank you.
Now, we'd like to welcome all of our new listeners to Extended and, of course, all of our regular listeners who have tuned in as usual. Welcome back and thank you for joining us again for what will be another massive episode. We've got a fantastic interview with another international best-selling author, and that is David Gledhill. And that interview will come up shortly with Gareth. It's also the start of our fourth year of Extended. Our first show went out in May 2012, and now we're on to episode 40. Tim, I worked out that we've invested about 1,000 man hours of our collective time into those episodes. Goodness knows how much we've all put in on the social media side on top of that, but it's been a great time. Some amazing guests, some amazing topics. And of course, in our last show, the Tomcat special, I think we broke the box office, probably our most successful show so far.
Doesn't time fly when you're having fun?
Yes, it does. And Tim, I think you've got us a new X10 top 10 later on in the show. So look forward to that. And Amy has sent us also a new pods challenge. So we look forward to that as well. There's a lot to get through, so let's get going with what's caught our eye in the news recently. Now, there's been a lot of sad news with the Germanwings A320 flight 9525, of course, and the runway overruns as well, Asiana flight OZ162 and Air Canada flight 624. But there's also been some other news items as well, Tim, to maybe have a little look at. Rolls-Royce got its $9.2 billion engine deal from Emirates, and we saw the first air-to-air refueling of the UCAV, of course, the Northrop Grumman X-47B.
Yeah, obviously, Joan Wings is something that's still under investigation. A lot of faults and issues arising from that. It's kind of, put a black cloud over the industry a little bit.
Tim, it's very sad news as well for everyone involved in that. Of course, our thoughts go out to all of friends and relatives there. It's been a particularly tough month for Airbus, hasn't it? The two runway excursions as well, both landing a little early.
The fact of the matter is the A320 is one of the, it's a workhorse. It's one of the most popular airliners in the world. So statistically, getting involved in landing incidents like that is not unusual. It's not a sign of anything that's gone wrong with the aircraft.
No.
But it does seem, to have both hit the ILS antennas on landing, does seem that to perhaps, people ought to be looking at stabilized approaches, low approaches, that sort of thing, and airlines might be having a quick look at their training and just to make sure that people are making the correct approach and flight path. What do you think, Tony?
Well, of course, when these accidents happen, the regulators always think very carefully about what they need to do. The Lufthansa one's absolutely unbelievable, really, and I don't know what the regulators will make of it. It's a very worrying thing, really, that it could happen.
Yeah, very sad indeed. But some positive notes, particularly for the UK, is Rolls-Royce's order for the engines from Emirates, Tim. That's great news for an organisation that's had a troubling year.
Definitely. That's a huge order for 217, I think, Trent 900 engines for 50 Airbus A380s. Obviously, there's some spares there on top of it. And that is their biggest order, biggest order ever for a UK engineering company.
I don't think a lot of people in this country don't realise what a fantastic firm Rolls-Royce is and what they're doing. They really are right at their peak technically. Right, they're a wonderful firm.
Exactly.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely brilliant. They're doing a fantastic job, and the Trent engine is superb. And of course, powering the A380, it's a bit different, a bit special, I think.
I think so. And interesting there. Also, there's the idea about are Airbus going to do an A380neo? Emirates has been kind of pushing them to go down that route. They said at the press conference that they have options to convert to a new type of A380 if Airbus were to launch it. However, they want the next batch of A380s pretty quickly, these next 50 in pretty quickly from 2016 onwards. So that's not much time, really, for Rolls to develop a new new engine which would blend the Trent, say, 900 with the XWB from the A350 engine technology for them to come up with a new engine. So possibly the pressure is a little bit off Airbus now to do the A380neo.
Right. Okay. Now, intriguing, the first air to air refueling test of the UCAV, the X-47B as well. This really now opens the floodgates, doesn't it, to unmanned operations in other sectors? What do you think, Tim?
You get a lot of press releases and a lot of people saying, this is game changing stuff. But in this case, I think it is. They've already done the first fixed wing carrier, landing on an aircraft carrier with X-47B, and then suddenly, just about before they're about to retire it, they say, "Hey, we've done air to air refueling and passed fuel." That's pretty amazing. I suspect that in the black world of secret projects, this has happened somewhere else before. But even then, it's still a game changer. You have an asset that could fly over over denied territory, keep coming back for fuel, go back out again. The limits now are only, does it carry weapons? Does it expend all its weapons, or stuff like oil, or oil in the engine, to keep it up there?
Of course, my butt in. The unmanned aircraft obviously been led by the military development, but as it's going to spin off in the civil, in my opinion, it's only a matter of time. Everybody looks a bit horrified, but the commercial attraction, certainly on the freighter, of having unmanned aircraft, are amazing. I think we have the technology right now. It's a matter of the regulations to make certain that it's absolutely safe to do so. But I think it's going to happen.
Tony, what's your view of this whole unmanned environment? I know you've flown, and we'll get to talk to you shortly about some of the aircraft types you've flown, but you've flown some aircraft single-handedly that should, I suppose, technically have had two pilots in. I mean, the Vulcan springs to mind. You've flown that on your own. What's your view about potentially future aircraft of that sort of size without a pilot at the controls?
Well, as I just said, I think it's bound to happen. The commercial pressures will be there. And the attractions, I'm sure, to operators not having two pilots, and having an aircraft, you know, without just pilotless, must be enormous. And as I said, technically, there's nothing to prevent it happening. I believe it's really a matter of regulations and obviously investment on development. But I believe it's going to happen. Of course, in my fiction books, my last one in particular, I cover unmanned, but that's in the military role, a very highly developed military unmanned aircraft. But these things are going to happen. The rate at which technology is advancing is incredible. And when you think what's happened the last few years, so for all the people who are frightened about it, I'd say it's going to happen.
Okay, Tony, we're going to come back and talk to you about some of those amazing aircraft that you've flown and some of those books after the break.
Thank you very much.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Air 1545, turn right, November Alpha, November Kilo, November Bravo, and then contact the ramp.
Hello, to the ramp, United 1145. 1545, we're off the ramp here.
United 1545, Sagan, you're off to the side of the taxiway there.
Oh, that's affirmative, United 1545.
Roger that. Are you clear? Looks like you're clear of the whole short lines there. For United 1545, we'll get a tug out for you.
United 1545, thank you.
Is there any tugs on frequency? United 1545, you guys, everybody okay down there?
Sir, we don't seem to have any injuries reported at this point in time. Aircraft secured.
Okay, so we're on this show. You've already heard him to have on this episode extended. Someone I think many of you will be interested in hearing from. Former Avro Chief Test Pilot and Aviation Author Tony Blackman. When you see a photo of someone sat next to Captain Winkle Brown and Neil Armstrong, you know you have a very special guest on the show tonight. Tony, welcome to Extended again.
Thank you.
You've had a pretty amazing career being involved with test flying all three V-bombers and the Nimrod, as well as with Smith Industries and then with the CAA, as well as branching out and deriving aviation, non-fiction and fiction. Let's go back to the beginning. I mean, what inspired you to fly in the first place? I believe you were quite unusual in that maths rather than flying was your way into the RAF.
Well, it was pure luck, really. I've been very lucky in all my career. It was pure luck. I was called up to do my national service, and I was teaching maths and physics, but it so happened that they were student pilots and navigators. And having done that for a year or so, they asked me to join one of the courses and learn to fly, and I couldn't resist it.
Brilliant. You joined the RAF and then you flew Vampires and Venoms in Germany. So what was that like, being on the tip of the spear in the Cold War?
Well, yes, I just suppose I should have been more conscious, but I wasn't more conscious. We weren't all that conscious. I wasn't of the Cold War. It was, of course, a wonderful time there flying flying the aircraft, and we had all the correct training, and we used to go off and do all the gun firing up North Germany. It was a very interesting time, and of course the aircraft were being developed all the time. We started on Vampires, we went to Venoms, and the Hunters were just about coming along as I was leaving.
Was there much kind of low-level flying? I hear stories, I read about stories about people kind of flying under bridges and all that kind of stuff.
I don't remember too much about the low-level stuff. I remember all the high-level stuff we used to do. We certainly, in our squadrons, it was mostly high-level, and we didn't do a lot of low-level stuff at all.
So you then trained as a test pilot and went on to join AV Row at the time. So that must have been a particularly exciting time to join the company.
Well, it was. I was, again, fortunate. I was on the acceptance team for the first RAF Vulcan Mark I, and so the Admirals got to know me. And I don't know whether you remember, but at the time there was a project, the 730 Mach 3 bomber, which was specified, and Avro's won the competition for it, and they wanted a project pilot to see it right through from beginning to end, and so that's why they recruited me. But of course, shortly after I joined Avro's, the Avro 730 was cancelled. But of course, we had lots of work on. Very luckily, we had the Mark II Vulcan coming along,
and the Avro 730, that would have been the kind of the British version of the SR 71, presumably.
Oh, it was amazing aircraft. It was amazing, I think. And it was a television that there was no transparency for the pilot to look out. It was going to be a TV. It was going to be TV cameras, and we'd have to fly it through the TV.
Wow. As chief test pilot, then you then went on to help develop the Vulcan, the Nimrod, the Victor tanker, and the Avro 748. Which was your favourite out of all of these, and why?
Well, of course, the Vulcan was a splendid aircraft to fly. I mean, with a stick, and the way the aircraft handled, it was magnificent. And just landing the Vulcan was always a delight. It was superb. So I used to like. In fact, I was very lucky enough. I flew the Concorde once on a test flight. And again, it was absolutely a great thing, a great experience. But on the other of the aircraft that the 748 was a very interesting aircraft. It was a workhorse. It wasn't a delight to fly in a way, but it was earning its keep.
Yeah,
it was a very interesting aircraft.
Now, obviously, in those days, a test pilot's work could be pretty dangerous. Have you any incidents that stick out in your mind where you think, "Phew, I'm lucky, I got away with that"?
Well, no, I think I've been very lucky. Of course, test flying is all about minimising risk, and very fortunate. I didn't really have any incidents at all. I was very lucky. My predecessor had a complete electrical failure. And he got the crew out. That was a wonderful. He did an absolute great job, but luckily nothing like that happened to me.
Hairy incidents. You relate when you were at Hawker Siddeley. You had the rare opportunity to fly Howard Hughes in a HS 748 when he visited the UK in the 1970s, and he hadn't flown for quite a while, but wanted to take control. So tell us about that.
Well, that was amazing, of course. I think the everyone called it Mission Impossible because he was a great one for seekers, you know. And I was the project pilot of the 146 when it started. And originally, before it was stopped, I was going down to Hatfield to take over there. They didn't have a launch customer for the 146, and Howard Hughes at the time owned Hughes Air West, and so when he wanted to fly, I regard this as a great marketing opportunity. But of course, when he wanted to fly, it wasn't like an airline departure. He apparently could never make up his mind, but eventually he did turn up and fly, and I flew him a couple of times in the 748, and I'm going to read my book, my autobiography about that, because it's quite a story. And then he went on to fly the 125. And he really knew where the ground was. There's no question about that. The only problem was that he always wanted to land on the first inch of the runway. And all he wanted to do was circuits and bumps. And he said to me, "You're not the first guy who's criticized my landings." it was all, as I say, I wrote it all up. It was a great marketing opportunity, but unfortunately, he broke his hip, and then there was the fuel, there was that fuel cut off, he left and went away. But of course, in The Aviator, DiCaprio justified the way he played Hughes. But all I can tell you is that when I flew with him, he was just I thought at the time, an old man. I realize now he was a youngster, but he was very courteous, very polite, and he was a splendid chap. He was said to be deaf, but we talked about the 146 in the 125 cabin after the flight. And in fact, I took him all around the 146 mock-up, and he was absolutely completely normal. Great chap, very courteous.
Amazing. From that sort of anecdote, and also from your fiction, it seems that marketing and selling aircraft in those days was a pretty cutthroat business. Do you think that has changed now, or has safety triumphed?
Well, of course, who knows how things go. As a human nature doesn't change, the problem is, of course, that it doesn't take much money for people to alter what they do. And, of course, the sums of money are absolutely advanced. And, of course, it's all a matter of degree. In one of my books, I describe what used to happen in the aircraft competitions, no holds barred. And now, of course, it's done much more in a much more sophisticated manner. But in the end, of course, there'll always be competition.
Definitely, yeah. On the next one, your book on Nimrod, you're well known for test flying Nimrod. Nimrod Rise and Fall charts the story behind the UK's submarine Hunter. Are you optimistic that the UK will regain this capability? And what aircraft type would you pick to be the new MPA if you were in power?
Well, we need it, but I'm not sure we can afford it. The system in the MRA-4, which was cancelled, it had a Boeing system which was working perfectly. It was a great system. And, of course, it was cancelled, but Boeing have the system on their P-8. And I think the Australians and I think the Indians have bought the P-8 or are buying it. And that's the obvious aircraft, in my view, for the UK to buy, but whether we can afford it, I have no idea.
Okay. At Smith's, you were at Smith's Industries, and you helped develop kind of flight management systems and advanced avionics. What do you think about sort of today's generation of pilots? Are they now too trusting of the glass cockpit and the computers?
I don't know. I don't think I can really comment on that because it's a different world now. The way with the electronic flight bags and everything, I think it's the people who fly now are very different from the way we used to fly. And quite honestly, I don't feel I can comment.
Okay. As well as the sort of non-fiction books you've written telling the story of the V-bomber's cruise and Nimrod, you've also put your vast experience into writing aviation thrillers. So what sort of research goes into these?
Well, I decided I would have an insurance investigator, a chap called Peter Talbot, and he figures in all the books. And obviously, I wrote it based on the experience I'd had of electronics. It's very difficult to write a credible fiction book because aircraft are so safe. It's very hard. And my last two have gone towards military, have a military connotation because I couldn't, because I say that's because the civil ones are so good, so incredibly safe. But obviously, I like to think that the civil ones I did write are technically accurate, and so I have this chap Peter Talbot who gets involved in them all. And my latest one, as I said, is involved with UAV, and it actually is one of the problems I had, of course, with my books, is that it's all about aircraft accidents, and so you can't very well sell them at the airports. And of course, I started writing so late that I wasn't able, you know, I had to self-publish. But what I do now is I put all my books, make them all e-books, and so if anybody, you can go to Kindle or Amazon anywhere, and you can download my books or my website. You can't download my books. You can have hard copies off my website, but there's links on my website for the e-books, and they, you know, they I don't sell a lot, but I sell quite a few. But I like to think they're all credible stories.
Tony, how many books have you actually authored?
Well, I've done 7 fiction, and I've done 6, I think, non-fiction. It's quite difficult on the fiction one with the same guy. You've got to be very careful that you keep track of his life. track of his life story, because unfortunately I married him off at the end, so that made it even harder.
So what book are you working on at the moment? What's the next fiction or non-fiction book?
Well, I have to admit I'm not actually at the moment. I'm just I'm pausing at the moment. I'm writing software at the moment, which is much harder.
Writing software? Wow.
I'm trying to write apps. It's very difficult. I find it very difficult at my age, but still.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't have time to write apps. Goodness me. Tony, I just wanted to take you back to the Empire Test Pilot School, and find out what it was like back then when you were flying as a test pilot. You talk of meeting some of the great test pilots, but you also talk of being there at a time when the British aviation industry and the manufacturing base was just about to turn. What was it like?
Well, yes, of course, because all the chief test pilots at that time didn't have the advantage, because they was during the war, so they didn't have the academic training which all test pilots have now. I was probably one of the first that went through the test pilot school, who had a degree. The other one, of course, we all admired very much the guys. I think we all admired all the people. I'm thinking of all the names now who came to talk. And then, of course,
Neville Duke.
Yes, and Roly Falk, of course, who employed me. And all these, they all came, and Brian Trubshaw, they all came and briefed us on what they were doing, which was always very interesting. Then, of course, there was the hard work on the course, having to learn. We had an awful lot to learn, and it kept us quite busy. I think nowadays, I think they're almost degree courses. If they're not degree courses, they're much higher technically than they were when we were there. But there was still a great technical need. And of course, the other thing I should have said was that the revolution that took place as I went through my career was that. Originally, all these big chief test pilots at the time, there was not much instrumentation, so everybody had to listen very carefully to what the chief test pilot said and respond. Whereas gradually you had teamwork developing, and instead of just a chief test pilot, you then had more and more technicians, you had instrumentation on the aircraft, and it became much more of teamwork. And it had to be, of course, to be economically successful. Of course, that's the thing I would have said. The one thing you have to remember of a firm's pilot is the firm has got to be relies on the aircraft being successful, and so you must make an aircraft just good enough. It's no good. When I started, we used to put bells and whistles on it, but certainly on the military stuff, but on the civil, you just have to meet the regulations, no more. And if the regulations are a bit lax, well, that's the way it is. You don't get any money for making the aircraft better than the regulations. And of course, it isn't just the regulations. You've got to meet the performance targets as well.
Interesting.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Tony, I'd just like to your career has kind of sort of spanned the kind, you know, from the sort of 50s to the sort of 70s and the. And beyond, and they, I wonder what your thoughts are on the post-war British aviation industry. As perhaps you've read James Hamilton Patterson's Empire of the Clouds. Do you subscribe to his view of kind of the decline or the squandering of the by politicians, or the short-sightedness?
I don't know whether to blame the politicians, but there's no doubt that unfortunately we gradually lost our lead. I suppose one of the reasons was you have to have a very big team, very expensive. Coming back to Rolls-Royce again, it really is unremarkable that they are able to do what they can do. But I suppose in developing an airplane, a successful commercial airplane, is even more demanding, more expensive. And we just couldn't do it by ourselves, and it's a great shame. You obviously saw that you saw that TV series, was it when Britain ruled the world or something?
That's right, yeah.
And it's so different now. Of course, it's very sad, but we're now down really to two large, well, there are more than two large manufacturers. Obviously, there are lots of other ones, but we just. I'm not sure I would join in blaming the politicians. I think the way technology has developed has a large part to play.
Okay. Finally, Tony, where can we find your fiction and your non-fiction books online and find you on Twitter?
Well, I don't know about where you find me on Twitter. I never remember. I'm not an egg. I go on it once or twice, but I certainly can't remember. But my non-fiction, my fiction books, you can just go to any, you just go to Kindle and just put my name in and the books will all appear. Or you can go onto my website and read what you're going to buy. And then you can, there's a link from each of my books. I think they're Kindle at the moment, and people can buy them like that. On the non-fiction, of course, it's they're advertised in the normal way. And but again, my non-fiction are now online. I think my latest two probably you've still got to have hardbacks.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll put links to those for you, Tony, in the show notes so that people can go directly to get those. Tony, I just wanted to jump in before Tim wraps up there and talk. How many aircraft types have you actually flown?
Oh, I haven't flown very many. I think I've flown 60. I mean,
That is a lot.
No, it's not like Winkle.
No.
I've only flown a few. As a firm's test pilot, you don't get once you join a firm, you don't get much chance to fly different types of aircraft. I think we were incredibly lucky at Avro's to think all the aircraft we had. I mean, we used Valiants for dropping blue steel, and of course when Handley Page stopped operating, we did the Victor Mark II development, which was a fantastic job.
Yeah.
Victor Mark II was a splendid tanker, and we did that. And of course, we had the Nimrod, and then we had the 748. So we had we were very lucky to have all those different types of aircraft in that short period of time.
And am I right in thinking that you test flew the first Vulcan Mark II, which of course was XH-558, which is in its final year?
I didn't do the initial on the Mark II. The initial Mark IIs were done by Jimmy Harrison, started on the prototype VX-777. But I did, obviously, 558 was the first, I say obviously, it was the first production Mark II. And unusually, the RAF crews always used to come and collect it. But this particular one, 5-8, being the first Mark II, and they hadn't flown it, I actually had to deliver it. It was a remarkable coincidence. I regard it as my baby when I see it flying now. First of July 1960, I delivered it to RAF Waddington. So,
Wow. We're going to come back to that a little later, but one final question, Tim, if I may, just before you wrap up. I did read somewhere that you had some interesting views on helicopters in your test flying days.
Well, I don't know, about interesting. We were the first course that had helicopters, and I reckoned that being a helicopter test pilot was a really dangerous job. and I certainly had the feeling that if you upset I can't remember his name. If you upset the chap in charge of the test pilot school, you were liable to get posted to D squadron. So I wasn't very good at flying helicopters. I regret it now. I wish I had learned to fly helicopters because I had the opportunity, but I certainly deliberately wasn't very good on the course because I didn't want to be posted to D squadron.
And you also got to fly a B-52 as well. What was that like?
Oh, yes. Well, I'm prouder of flying the B-47, actually, because...
Oh, wow.
I don't know whether you remember, but there was a Skybolt, this air-launched ballistic missile.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Which the Vulcan was going to carry. And in fact, it did carry. We did lots of drops, did a lot of flying with it. I did all the flying on that. And but they wanted to do some radio trials, and the radio trials had to be done on the West Coast. And so I volunteered to deliver the aircraft out to deliver a Vulcan out to Edwards, and they did their trials, and then I brought it back again. And of course, while it was there, we had to do air tests and things, and I did a swap so that I flew the B-52 and one of the other guys flew the Vulcan, and the same on the B-47.
Wow.
The B-47 was a fantastic aircraft. With this wonderful canopy, you felt you could see the whole of California. If you compare the view out of the V-bombers and that out of a B-47, the contrast is absolutely amazing. The B-52, from a view point of view, was just more like the V-bombers. It was an interesting aircraft.
Fantastic. Kind of reminds me also, as you say, about the sort of Skybolt and the Vulcan, some of the kind of odd concepts for. I think I've seen a concept for a Vulcan where it would be a kind of an interim air defense type with like long range missiles. It'd be kind of a weapon, you know, a missile truck to fire long range missiles. And also, I think there was some kind of idea as having parasite fighters in the form of gnats slung under the wings.
I don't remember that. I think the Skybolt was really the only thing. And of course, one of the great advantages of the Skybolt, even though the project was cancelled, was that all the wings had to be strengthened to carry the Skybolt. And so when the deterrent went low level, the Vulcan was able to do that because it then had a very good fatigue life.
Ah, right.
Unlike the Victor. The Victor, of course, was absolutely superb as a tanker, as I said earlier, but it wasn't able to do the low-level flying, which the Vulcan was able to do.
Tony, it's been absolutely fantastic to speak to you now. I hope you'll stick around for the rest of the show. We've got some more chat and aviation discussion coming soon. And,
thank you
for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
We know you're in there.
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
Circa 4360, Kennedy Ground, runway 31 left, just hold short stack 2A Alpha.
31 left, short hold short of Alpha, we need to get off the ground by 19.
You have to be airborne by 19?
Yeah, we're timing out.
Then you might as well cancel the flight now. The time is longer. You're not going to depart within 13 minutes. So Brickyard 4360, say intention.
Short of Alpha, taxi to Papa.
Brickyard 4360, say intention. Brickyard 4360, roger, left onto Bravo and hold short of Golf, give way to JetBlue off the left.
Now, before Gareth unfortunately went off ill, he got to speak to David Gledhill. Dave's career with the Royal Air Force spanned 34 years. And following on from our last episode, of course, the F-14 Tomcat special, Dave was an equivalent instructor. He carried out the role of air tactics instructor at 228 OCU on the F-4 Phantom and also at 229 OCU on the Tornado F-2. So here's Gareth's interview with David Gledhill.
Dave, welcome to Extended. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Gareth.
How are you?
I'm very well. It's a lovely morning.
It is, isn't it? Now, it's not the first time that you and I have sat down for a chat, because we've done a few bits for Global Aviation Resource, but nobody minds talking about Phantoms, do they?
Absolutely right. You know, standard air crew, you never get fed up of talking about the old aeroplanes.
Yeah. Now, before we have a little chat about what you did with the F-4 particularly, this is my opening gambit. And I've not given you a massive briefing, so I know you're going in quite cold on this.
Sure.
I think most of us would agree that the Phantom is already going to be, you know, is considered an icon, if you like, in the sort of aviation hierarchy. Why do you think that is? What was it, or is it, about the F-4 that has elevated it to such a status?
It's very difficult to say, and it's one of those things that I've pondered. And I suppose the main reason for that is having then switched to the F-3, which was probably all round better than the Phantom in most things that it did, most things. But yet, it didn't have the same charisma. And I think charisma is probably a word that is appropriate in this case. The Phantom somehow was, it was that type of aeroplane that when you flew a sortie, when you climbed out at the end of it, you knew you'd flown a sortie. And it looked after you. It was probably the first of the modern generation of aeroplanes that had quite a good safety record. I say good, I mean, even with its good safety record, we still lost anything up to an aeroplane a month at times during the Cold War. But the aeroplanes before that had been quite, quite challenging to fly. And the Lightning, for example, we lost aeroplanes regularly. Yeah. So you had a feeling that the aeroplane was actually looking after you. But it was just it just had that feel. It just had that look. It was functional. It did what it was supposed to do. I should also add that when I first started flying it, and I first flew in 1975 on the Phantom, it was the best. Our own British version was the best air defense aeroplane in Europe.
Yep.
Had a good radar. It had a look down, shoot down capability. It had comprehensive weapons, all aspect weapons. It was just good at what it did, even better than the American aeroplanes at the time. So you felt as though you were in an aeroplane that was worthy of its reputation.
We'll come on to talk a little bit about RAF Germany in a while, but I guess
sure.
at that period of time, when there was a whole multitude of different types, you know, all in that airspace on a day-to-day basis, you probably sort of felt like king of the hill, didn't you?
I think by the time I got to Germany, perhaps we were sort of, you know, we're a bit sort of like the Duke of York, probably on the way back down again, I think. But certainly my first tour in UK, then we were very much top of the pile. Nobody else. All the other, for example, the American F-4 that was flying at the time had a pulse-only radar. So it was good at medium level, but not good at low level. So I would say if you were looking for a pinnacle, and people that came later than me might disagree, but I would say probably about 1980 was when the Brit Phantom was at its height.
Okay. You're a navigator.
Mm.
This wonderful term that we still use to this day, really, I think, to some extent for the Royal Air Force.
Yes, we didn't do much navigation.
Exactly. your role was far more than telling the chap in the front which direction to turn. Just tell us a little bit about what your role was. You were fresh from training as well into the F-4, weren't you, as well?
I was, and the training didn't equip you to sit in the back of the Phantom at all. You know, it was very biased towards the Vulcan, the large V-force type operation. You know, sitting plotting in the back of a Dominie, you know, pointing backwards was the training. And the only thing we got to prepare us was about, I got the first lead-in course for the Phantom, and I got 24 hours on a jet provost, basically lines on charts, you know, visual navigation through the low flying areas.
Yeah.
There was no radar lead-in other than sitting for 10 hours in the back of a Hastings watching a Vulcan radar, which again didn't prepare you at all. So you really went into the Phantom absolutely cold. But that said, there wasn't much navigation to do. The Mark II version, the FGR-2 that I flew, actually had an inertial navigation system in the back seat, which would give you a range and a bearing to various navigation points. So for once, you had a latitude and longitude in the cockpit, and you could point at anywhere that you wanted to go. So, you know, getting around wasn't as difficult as it had been in the past. So my role was, and we all resisted it, but really I was a weapons systems operator. And later on the Air Force actually reclassified navigators as WISOs. But we in the Air Force were quite fiercely protective of the navigator brevet, so that was my title. Funnily enough, when we were flogging around the low-flying areas, it was actually the pilot in the front that was doing the navigation. And okay. It was only the more complex routes where we sort of helped out, you know, if it was an unusual route going somewhere different. So what was my role on a day-to-day basis? Well, the principal thing was the radar. It was a very comprehensive, complex radar system, operated by three bits of kit, basically, in the back cockpit. There was a radar display scope, which had a camera on top so that you could record everything that went on.
Yep.
There was a navigator hand controller on the right-hand side, which, with a thumb wheel on there, would move the scanner up and down.
I'm just going to interrupt you, Dave, very briefly. Sure. Nobody else will be able to see. You've actually got your video on, so I can see you at the moment. And right. You're actually, like, it's like you're sitting in the cockpit. You've just reached down for your controller, haven't you?
The thumb was going there.
Sorry, carry on.
This thing, and actually, I still have the hand controller from one of the aeroplanes, but it was a bit like an original computer game, you know, that the blip came up on the radar display, you could move a little acquisition marker around the display and squeeze a trigger. Once you squeezed that, then the radar would lock and track automatically, and that meant you could fire a semi-active missile, the Sparrow, and subsequently the Skyflash. The third part of the equipment was the radar control panel, and that sat down on the left-hand side by your left knee. And this had various operating modes, the pulse Doppler, the pulse, the mapping modes, and what have you, and various range scales and other selectors, and including things like electronic countermeasures modes. So using those three bits of equipment, you operated the scanner in front of you, you know, and found the target. And then once you'd found it, you set up an intercept profile and gave commands to the pilot to fly, headings, heights, speeds, the amount of angular bank, the pull if you needed a particular, you know, 4G pull or whatever.
Yep.
And by talking the pilot on, you got him into a position where he could launch a weapon before you saw the target. So the radar was the principal piece of equipment in the back. As the Phantom developed in British service, we added extra little bits of kit. There was a radar warning receiver built by Marconi, and this thing, if another radar illuminated you, it would flash a signal on its little display tube. By looking at that signal, you could identify the threat band. So, for example, a fish bed was a J-band signal, and a particular vector would come up on the tube, and then various other sequences of lights on the panel would allow you to identify that. And in your headphones, in the old bone dome there, you get little bleeps and squeaks, and by listening to that, you could hear the raw signal in the ether, and you could identify it from that as well. So you knew what was coming at you for the first time, which was really helpful. In addition to that, over the years, we added various things. We never got an active jammer on the Phantom, but we did have a chaff and flare system. It was the American system, the ALE-40, and dispensers mounted on the side of the inner wing pylons. You could mount sort of either chaff cartridges or flare cartridges within those dispensers, and you had little selectors to set up sequences of how they deployed, and a dispense button in the front and the back cockpit.
Okay.
So at any time you were threatened by another aircraft, you could dispense chaff and flares to try and counter the incoming missile. Those were the principal things that I did in the back. And as I said, very little navigation other than operating and setting up the inertial in the back.
And just a note for anyone that's wondering, if you look back at archive pictures, you can actually tell very easily which aircraft had the radar warning receiver fitted, can't you? That was a very obvious modification.
And only on the Brit Phantom. That was unique to our aeroplanes. And if you look at the fin cap of a British Phantom, it has a big square top on it. And basically the front and back of that square cap had two antennas mounted looking forwards and backwards. So you didn't have terribly good coverage on the side, on the beam, but you did have very good coverage fore and aft, and it was very accurate, actually, to within a couple of 5 degrees. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the fish bed there. That, of course, was the NATO call sign for the MiG-21.
It was,
and that leads us quite nicely onto maybe a bit of context here in terms of what was happening in the world at the time that you were sat in the back of a Phantom, because it was a very different place to what it is now in many ways.
Very different indeed. The Iron Curtain, or you know, the inner German border, as it was called, was a definite line on the map. Anybody who's looked at the old Cold War pictures, you would see a very heavily fortified boundary, watchtowers, cleared mine strips, dogs, armed guards. Really, sadly, to keep the East Germans in, not to keep us out. But it was a very clear division between the two blocks, NATO on one side, the Warsaw Pact on the other, which were the old satellite nations as well as Russia and some of the former communist states. So it was very much them and us. You felt that way. It was a daily thing, certainly in Germany when I was there. It was the ever-present division. We were, I think, perhaps in many ways, we were safer, although we've all read the nuclear scares of, you know, 2 seconds to button press and what have you. But it was in many ways, it was a good leveller, because I think governments were very wary of doing something controversial, because Russia might have reacted quite badly. The Warsaw Pact might have reacted quite badly. So in many ways, we were safer than we are now. It's a much more unpredictable world now. But the atmosphere on a NATO flying base was completely different to you'll see now. If you went down to Coningsby today, you'd actually see a base that looks, you know, people are walking around, you know, nice shirt sleeves and what have you. Cold War flying was an exercise probably once a week, maybe twice a month, something like that. The Hooter would go at 4 o'clock in the morning. You would run in, you would put your nuclear, biological, chemical suit on, and you'd spend a lot of the time contemplating a chemical war. Tin hats, everything painted green. It was quite a drab place when the Hooter went.
Yeah.
So the feel about a flying station was completely different to you'll see now.
The vision, I guess, or the, you know, in terms of where the Phantom would have fitted in, was, you know, that you guys would have been launching to sort of hold back the hordes of Soviet bombers as they approach the UK. Do you think you or anybody else actually genuinely thought that might happen?
Yeah, without a doubt. I was under no illusions that given certain circumstances they would roll over the border. And let me answer your questions in two ways. I think the UK situation was a lot different to the Germany situation.
Yeah.
And taking the Germany situation first, we expected massive armoured assault through the Fulda Gap, and then, you know, probably on two fronts down the inner German border. We expected a very quick push across the forward airspace. So bases like Gütersloh, we didn't expect to last 2 minutes. The Harriers would have deployed out into the field. They would probably have slowly worked backwards, and the forward area would probably have fallen quite quickly. We were at the back at Wildenrath. We were 20 minutes behind the border flying time. We figured we'd have a little bit longer, but we only had 22 jets. Therefore, attrition would have been high. Therefore, we would probably have expected to be the first line of defence and not to last too long. Personally, I expected we would last about a week, if that, before it became completely untenable. Our thought then was we would probably roll back to the UK.
Okay.
The concepts at the time were that the Soviets would roll over Western Germany and be at the Channel ports in 5 days. And there is absolutely no doubt if their logistics chains held up, they could have done that quite happily. So it was a very tense atmosphere in Germany at the time, and we thought we were under threat, without a doubt. Step back to UK to answer the second part of your question. A lot different. As you rightly said earlier, we would have faced hordes of Soviet bombers, the Bears, the Bisons, the Badgers, and latterly the Backfires. And it would have been a medium-level war rather than a low-level war over the North Sea, countering Soviet long-range bombers, probably firing standoff missiles. So the UK system was, it had a layered defence, missiles right at the back, inner caps probably mounted by Lightnings with their shorter range and less missiles, middle caps and outer caps mounted by Phantoms with 8 missiles and a gun if needed, or a centerline tank to give extra range, plus tankers. Bear in mind, in those days, it was a very heavily... the ground environment, UK ground-based radars, the Shackleton was not very good as an airborne early warning platform. latterly the E3 was. So what you have is this layered defense. And the idea of the middle caps was to catch the manned bomber that was coming in to either take pictures or to drop conventional bombs. The outer caps were there to try and catch the long-range missile shooters before they managed to get their missiles in the air. And bear in mind, these missiles could have been nuclear-armed. They were certainly long-range, and they were certainly targeted at our military installations and our ports and cities. Maybe not cities, ports, certainly. So that was the concept, you know, to try and catch people a lot farther out. And we expected there to be heavy electronic warfare, heavy jamming, heavy comms jamming, and the like. So two entirely different battles between the UK and Germany.
It's actually quite chilling to sit here, you know, on this lovely sunny spring morning in the UK and think about that. It's you know, for anyone listening who's you know, who maybe didn't grow up or didn't live through that, it's you know, we don't live in a perfect world, Dave, do we? Far from it. But actually, at least we're maybe not sitting here thinking that something like that might happen at any given moment.
And it always worries us, you know. You get to things like Putin starting to saber rattle, you know, and yep. there is that sort of background feel of, ooh, this sounds a little bit Cold War. But the most chilling aspect of it, though, was that every exercise, both UK and Germany, ended up with a nuclear phase. We were expecting to be hit by nuclear weapons. There was a thing called a survival scramble, where aeroplanes launched into the air. You got every serviceable aeroplane airborne, went out to essentially a holding combat air patrol in the North Sea, and waited until that nuclear attack had finished, and hopefully there was then somewhere to come back to. Now, that was chilling.
And presumably your expectation of potentially having somewhere to go back to was quite low, I would imagine.
Indeed, and I think places like Coningsby, Binbrook, and what have you would have been the prime targets, I would expect, to try and extract attrition on the UK Air Defence Forces.
I guess the other thing that is very interesting, and I know because you and I have talked about this before, is that on a day-to-day basis, particularly when you're flying in Germany, this wasn't just a concept, was it? This was very real, and there were lots of games of sort of cat and mouse that went on around that border that you've talked about. And some of those, you know, is it fair to say that notched the tension up a little bit in a very real term?
It did, and I told one of the stories in my first book, Phantom in Focus, and we sat quick reaction alert, and we were on 5 minutes readiness, you know, 24 hours of the day, 7 days a week. And on one occasion, we were launched for a border patrol, and that was quite regular. You know, we'd go and run up and down the border, particularly on a nice blue day, and just show a presence. This one particular occasion, we launched and we headed up to towards Hanover, which was at the top end of the inner German border. As we tracked over there, our TACAN, the Tactical Air Navigation System, a radio beacon aid that we had in the cockpit, was showing firmly to the east. This thing had been, it was called Mekoning, and the Soviets had attacked our particular beacon and were giving us false indications. And our position looked as though we were 30 miles away from where we were. Had we gone to that position of the TACAN, we would have been over East German airspace. So they were hoping to lure us across the border and make an incident out of it. It got worse, actually, because as we came back south, there was on the inner German border, there was a very distinctive sort of kick in the border, and the border extended well into Western Germany, sort of, you know, in terms of a north-south line.
Yeah.
We were heading south towards that particular jink in the border, and suddenly there was very loud music on the radio frequency. Now, bear in mind, you were under positive radar control in the air defense interception zone, which was the little zone right next to the border. And we were expecting a call from our controller to turn onto 240 or 270 away from the border. And basically, as we were expecting that call, the rock music sort of blasted out the frequency. Yeah, cool. So being good chaps and looking down on the ground and seeing this big scar on the ground, we turned onto west and then switched to our secondary frequency and re-established control. But again, it was they first of all tried to jam our TACAN. They secondly tried to get us to infringe airspace on this little nick in the border, and failed. So we had another incident of this with more music, more noise on the frequency. So eventually we were told to go home, and you know, we had a debrief. And subsequently it turned out they showed us the systems on the ground that had been jamming us. They showed us what had happened and who'd been in control of it. And more importantly, there was a MiG on the other side of the border that had been launched specifically to be there in case we did infringe on the airspace. So yes, it was a constant battle, you know, constant sort of cat and mouse game of, you know, if we can screw you around, we will.
Wow, incredible stuff. And I mean, bringing things forward to the present day, you just mentioned Phantom in Focus, that and many other stories were in your first book, and you've now turned into what David can only describe as being a prolific author, I think.
I've been tapping away.
so we'll come on to a couple of the others in a second, but it started with Phantom in Focus. Is that, and I mean, you're obviously a photographer as well. We must mention that. Lots of your own pictures in there. Is that something that you always felt you wanted to do?
You know, I think it was more a case of capturing the experiences. You know, I tried to carry my camera when I could in the cockpit, although it was difficult, you know, to carry quite a bulky camera. There was nowhere to store it in a Phantom, so you kind of ended up strapping it in front of you on the rack in front there. But I did carry it whenever possible, and I did, if I went on detachment or anything like that, take it along with me. So I never tried to set up specific sorties or photographic events, with one or two exceptions. But if there was a good picture, I'd snap away, and I did regularly. So the pictures were the basis of Phantom in Focus as a first book. But luckily, I kept on doing it over the years, although there were some fairly long gaps, particularly when I was an instructor, where there are, you know, the photographic record is a bit slim. but after that, I chose the next two books were parts of my life, and one was Fighters Over the Falklands, which was very much focused on how we operated down south, both on the Phantom and on the Tornado F3. And then the one that's just come out, Tornado F3 in Focus, I tried to sort of emulate Phantom in Focus in some ways in terms of format. But I guess the content of Tornado F3 in Focus is a little bit more towards the politics of the aeroplane, the development, the modification states. Of course, the epic Fox Hunter saga of the early days, where it wasn't really working very well. So it's a little bit more the background to the aeroplane than Phantom, which was more about what went on in the cockpit. You know,
and we must just expand on that slightly, Dave. Let's give the F3 every opportunity to stand up for itself. Yeah. If you're firmly in the Phantom camp, I think you're probably still there to this day, saying that the F4 was replaced by an aircraft that, you know, wasn't as capable or as charismatic. You know, and actually, in terms of capability, charisma doesn't really come into it, but it's still a drum that people beat. And yes, there were problems with the F3, but the F3 did, and the full story is in the book. But it did actually turn into an incredibly capable aircraft, didn't it?
And I do hope I've tried to lay those myths to rest in the book. When it first came into service, undoubtedly it didn't work. It was underdeveloped. It was undertested. So we had a basket case on day one. It really didn't work at all. So all those, but for the catch is, its reputation was based on that, and I think people don't think it ever developed beyond that stage. And certainly the crew room banter was along those lines.
Yeah.
Now, what happened, and because of my positions, I was in the Ministry of Defence on two occasions, very closely involved with the S3 and the developments and the modifications. I've been able to tell the story from an insider perspective, and it, without a doubt, it developed, and it developed extremely well. And the aircraft that went out of service was arguably the most capable aeroplane of its time. And I would say that including things like the F-15. In its beyond visual range role, it had superb situation awareness with the data links it had on board.
Yeah.
By then, the Fox Hunter developed to Stage 3 standard. And bear in mind that Stage 1 didn't come in until 1990, so Stage 3 standard. And it had defensive aids and various other modifications fitted that made it an extremely capable aeroplane. And I'm very jealous of the crews that got to fly the final standard, because it must have been really good. The bit that never, the icing on the cake that never really came, was it never had a helmet-mounted sight, which would have made fearsome in combat. it didn't have certain visual acquisition systems, which even the Phantom had, you know, had a simple rifle scope, for example. So there were a few things that were never quite there. It never got fitted with big engines like the EJ-200, although that was looked at but never implemented. Yeah. So the final icing was never there, but it was without doubt a very capable aeroplane. And some of the stuff that you see online is just not true, you know.
Okay, well that's our little bit of F3 stuck up for today. Yeah. Before we go, let's just talk about fiction.
Yeah.
Because certainly your Cold War experiences, not only have you managed to, and I think we should all be very grateful that you've put your own personal experiences down in writing, because I think that, yeah, that's brilliant to get that history saved. But you've also translated that to a couple of works of fiction as well. Tell us about that.
I'm up to three now. Yeah. Funny enough, the Defector, which was my first work of fiction I wrote many years ago, about 10 years ago, maybe even more. And that tracked a sort of a fictional Soviet fighter pilot defecting to the West, bringing his Su-27 Flanker with him. I like to say that all the books on the fiction side, they're faction. So I try to base it, I mean, Defector was based at Wildenrath, so I try to, you know, talk about Wildenrath as it was. Certainly the Phantom, all the descriptions of it, the weapon systems, what happens in the cockpit and all that, all the kind of stuff that I describe is based on fact. Obviously, the actual storyline is pure fiction, and but hopefully it adds to the way the story's told. I've produced three so far. Defector was the first, with this story of the SU-27. And then I followed up quite recently with one called Maverick, which is based in the Falkland Islands. It's about an Argentinian A4 pilot that decides to have a go at the Falklands post-conflict.
Okay.
And basically, he makes an attack across the water through the defended airspace against Port Stanley. And it's the story about how that, you know, that attack develops and what happens afterwards. And then the third one, literally hot off the press, I've just released it this last week, is called Deception. And that's based in the Middle East. And there was a situation in about 1982-83, and it was called, wonderful name, Operation Pulsator.
Right.
And this was a formation of Buccaneers and Phantoms that were deployed from RAF Akrotiri in Cyprus. And they were sent on a show of force across the Lebanon. I use that as the basis, but the story is basically a hostage that's taken in Beirut. And this combined air operation is mounted to try and release the hostage from captivity. And I based that sort of story on the Amiens raid of World War II, where they dropped the sort of prison walls using bombs and what have you. So it's all the story around that. And throughout the three novels, it's the same Phantom crew that do their thing and normally come home for tea and medals. And so I've tried to keep a common theme, and they appear on all three. So yeah, and it's great fun writing the fiction, because of course you're allowed to, although it's based in fact, you're allowed to sort of invent things and do stuff that never happened or could happen.
I know that they are doing and have all done very well. Again, something you and I have touched upon chatting, and I know that Dale Brown has come up on the podcast before because of Flight of the Old Dog and stuff like that. But with him and sort of Stephen Koontz, even Tom Clancy, we seem to have had a lot more of that before. And you know, I guess there's a little gap that you're filling now. It just doesn't seem to be so much of that around anymore.
Well, I'm hoping, but surprisingly, the modern literary world doesn't seem to want that sort of, you know, the aviation thriller, which is surprising. So I've gone ahead and just filled the gap myself. And, you know, I certainly wouldn't put myself in the same category as those wonderful authors that you've just mentioned. But hopefully, you know, the sort of Andy McNab style of, put the reader there, that's what I'm striving for. And the people that are reading them enjoy them, and they're sitting high in their categories on Amazon at the minute. So,
and is there more on the way?
Say again?
More on the way?
Oh, yes. Well, there's two more factual ones coming.
Yep.
There's one called Tornado in Pictures, which is actually a showcase for a chap called Darren Willman. And Darren is an aviation photographer, does some wonderful work, and basically the publisher asked me just to add some context to it. So what I've tried to do is a little bit of description. It'll cover all the marks of Tornado. But I've tried to add a little bit of aircrew value added of, and for example, one linking passage. I talked about a fictional training sortie between some Tornado F3s getting airborne from Coningsby, Tornado GR1s getting airborne from Marham, and how they would interact as they went around a typical training sortie. That's so fantastic. That kind of thing. But it's principally the pictures. I'm working on another factual one for Font Hill Media, which will be out hopefully turn of the year, and that's called Operational Test Honing the Edge. So I'll look in there at my sort of operational test experience of how we tested aeroplanes, what we did, how we did it, and where we went to do it. And that'll be out at the end of the year. And another novel, working on another novel, that's called Provocation. And that's going to look at a Berlin Corridor type scenario. So we used to fly exercises called the Bold Series, Bold Encounter, Bold Pointer.
Yeah.
That would be our role to reinforce a Berlin Corridor operation. So if the Soviets tried to close the corridors, we'd put fighter aeroplanes in to escort a transport down the corridor and, you know, that kind of scenario. And this, the latest novel will explore that sort of, you know, the tensions and the what happens when the force sort of penetrates the corridor and bad guys coming from the other side and that kind of thing. So,
am I right in saying that the testing book is written in conjunction with somebody who's also got some very interesting tales to tell?
Yes. Yeah, I'm co-authoring the testing book with David Lewis, who is a very experienced weapons instructor, both on the Phantom and the Tornado F3. David actually worked on the Operation Evaluation Unit, the F3OEU, and then latterly he was a test navigator for British Aerospace Systems up at Wharton, flew both the Tornado F3 and the GR4. So very experienced. We both joined the Air Force at the same time. But DL has lots of stories to tell, and hopefully then we'll get a balance. So, yeah, it should be interesting.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for joining us. It's always good fun to talk to you, and I'm sure everyone's going to enjoy listening. And we might, you know, there'll probably be a few questions. And I know that you're sort of readily available on Facebook and groups and things like that. And so, and we can put the links to some of those groups for the F4 and the Tornado in the show notes for this episode, and also tell people where they can get hold of all the wonderful books. If indeed they haven't read them already. So thank you so much for joining us. And
you're very welcome. And as you said right at the beginning, you know, ex-aircrew, we're always happy to talk about our aeroplanes. So anybody that wants to join in on sort of discussion online, I'm more than happy. And I know lots of mates that are there as well that would be equally happy to chat.
Brilliant. Great to chat. And we'll speak to you again soon.
You too, Gareth.
Thanks, Dave.
Great interview by Gareth there, Tim. We forget what it was like in the Cold War. He did remind us what it was like. I thought it was really interesting, that point about having no airbase to potentially go back to when it all kicked off, and they just went to a holding point over the North Sea. Really interesting stuff.
Definitely. It's also, I find it interesting as well about Dave mentioning the charisma of the Phantom compared to the Tornado F3. Tony, yeah. Which aircraft have you flown or not flown, but you think have got added oomph?
Sorry, I'm not sure I follow you there.
the charisma of you know, certain aircraft has got a certain charisma, or just even if they don't kind of handle particularly well, or were not particularly suited to, they've got charisma. Have you got any personal favourites?
Well, the thing that amazed me, coming back to books, was Lightning. The first of the Boys series, Lightning Boys, sold incredibly well, and I was amazed that it's outsold Volker Boys. I'm not sure it is now, but it certainly did initially. And the Lightning seemed to have made a great impression on everybody. And though the Vulcan is still flying, I'm still amazed how the memory of the Lightning. Obviously is a very well known, rather like the Spitfire in a way. That's the aircraft that obviously caught a lot of people's imagination.
Did you ever get to fly the Lightning?
No, I'm afraid not. I would have liked to have flown that. Mind you, we didn't fly for very long by all accounts. It's just, well, I had to come down again. But obviously, it must have been a fantastic experience. The Vulcan had for a big aircraft, the Vulcan was fantastic. We used to have 64,000 pounds of thrust, and at Farnborough we could fly it at about 100,000. So that was a pretty lively operation. But I was always very disappointed that we were never allowed to do, at Farnborough to demonstrate the rapid start and takeoff. But Harry Broadhurst has just joined us as managing director at Manchester, and he said, no, it'll delay the program if we delay the development program of the engines if we go to go to Farnborough. So that was one of my disappointments. I did a lot of flying at Farnborough, but I'd love to have done the one where you fire the red lights fired and you roared into the air, starting all four engines at the same time.
That would have been brilliant. And just thinking one more about the Phantom again, and the Phantom and the Vulcan. Is it true that the Vulcan could outmaneuver fighters like the Phantom at high altitude? That because of the big wing, the ones that just kind of drop out of the sky.
Well, if you read my Vulcan Boys book, it definitely is. I've had no personal experience, but it's on every page. You know the chaps who flew it against the Phantom said how good the aircraft was.
Excellent.
And I must say, for those who haven't read any of Tony's books, they really, really are worth going to Amazon and downloading. So highly, highly recommended. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and after that, we're going to come back and hear Tim's new top 10.
Oh, good evening, Lufthansa 424 Heavy, established Islet 04 right.
Lufthansa 424 Heavy, Boston, good evening. The wind is 200 at 11 runway 4 right, clear to land. Previous arrival of Heavy Boeing 777, caution, wake triples.
Lufthansa 424 Heavy, clear to land, 04 right, thank you.
Lufthansa 424 Heavy, only available turnoff for you is at the end of November.
At the very end of November, leaving the runway, Lufthansa 424 Heavy.
And 30 knots tailwind on touchdown.
I just looked under 424 Heavy, copy that.
Copy that. A wind check for 04 right.
Wind 190 at 11.
24 is going around.
Under 424 Heavy, right to climb, maintain 3000, fly runway heading.
Under 424, climbing 3000 feet, runway heading.
Select F8 is Tango's current Boston altimeter 3037.
American 1355, just outside Mel.
Under 424 Heavy, contact Boston departure 133.0.
Lufthansa 424 Heavy 1330. The reason for the go around was too much tailwind.
Copy that.
Hey, the wind again.
Wind 200 at 13, American 1355. And we are changing runways. You were the last one for 4 right, and we can resequence you for 22 left or 27 if you'd like.
Seabird 203 Heavy holding at November.
203 Heavy, Boston Tower, hold short runway 4 left, traffic landing.
Hold short, 4 left, Seabird 203.
Whiskey Alpha, just be advised, we'll be changing runways momentarily, departing runway 22 right soon. For 203 Heavy, turn left onto runway 22 right and taxi down 22 right, hold short runway 33 left.
Left on 22 right, hold short of 33 left, Speedbird 203.
Okay, and we're back. And we've now got our X10 top 10. So without further ado, with Solar Impulse 2 currently making its way around the world, we take a look at the top 10 record-breaking aircraft. At number 10, the Mil V-12, a beast of a helicopter. Designed in the Soviet Union, the 1968 Mil V-12 still retains the title of world's largest helicopter and still keeps four records for rotorcraft heavy lift. With a transverse rotor layout, the twin rotors are 114 feet in diameter. The Mil V-12 has a max takeoff weight of 105 tons. Only two were built. When the Red Army thinks your helicopter is too massive for practical use, you know you've built it too big. At number 9, Ferry Delta 2. While the post-war aviation world saw the UK aerospace industry arguably overtaken by the might of the US in military and commercial spheres, for one brief glorious period in the mid-50s, the Ferry Delta 2 wrestled a key speed record back for Great Britain, becoming the first aircraft ever to exceed 1,000 miles per hour in level flight. The Ferry Delta 2 also probably holds the world record for the most beautiful record-breaking prototype. At number 8, Hughes H-4 Hercules. When the US was facing the problem of how to invade an occupied Europe in the dark days of World War II, it turned to aviation genius Howard Hughes. The result was the H-4 Hercules, or Spruce Goose. Powered by 8 Pratt & Whitney Wasp engines, the Spruce Goose still remains the largest seaplane ever built, and even in the age of the A380 and 747, has the largest wingspan, 320 feet, of any aircraft. At number 7, F-15 Streak Eagle. Think a Ferrari XR8's fast? How about 0 to 98,000 feet in 3 blistering minutes and 27 seconds. This is one of 8 time-to-climb records set by a specially stripped-down McDonnell Douglas F-15A in 1975, the ultimate hot-rodded fighter. And number 6, Zephyr. The only UAV on this list, the solar-powered Airbus Defence and Space Zephyr, originally developed by Kinetic, gains a place on this for its outstanding endurance record, spending 2 weeks airborne in 2010, doubling the previous endurance record. Rumour has it that they could have stayed up longer, but the engineers on the ground got bored. At number 5, the Spirit of St. Louis. Even today, flying a single-engine piston across the Atlantic from New York to Paris would be a challenge. And radios, GPS, emergency beacons and other navigation and safety aids would be essential. In 1927, though, most people thought it was suicide. Enter Charles Lindbergh and the Ryan Spirit of St. Louis. An aircraft packed with so much fuel there was no forward vision except for a periscope. The aircraft was also unstable in pitch, roll and yaw, but had the benefit of keeping Lindbergh alert on the 40-hour flight. And number 4, Supermarine S6B. Immediately after World War I, the biggest advances in aircraft and engine technology were in racing seaplanes, thanks to the hotly contested Schneider Trophy series. With a monoplane airframe designed by Supermarine's legendary R.J. Mitchell and a highly tuned Rolls-Royce R engine, the S6B permanently won the trophy for Britain in 1931. But more importantly, this record breaker and its power plant led to the development of the iconic Supermarine Spitfire, the fighter that was to play a critical role in 1940. And number 3, Voyager. Designing radical aircraft is Bert Rutan's speciality, and none was perhaps more radical than the Voyager, which in 1986 became the first ever aircraft to fly around the world unrefueled. Piloted by Dick Rutan and Janine Yeager, the aircraft took 9 days to fly around the globe, taking off and landing from Mojave in California. Since then, the Rutan-designed Global Flyer allowed Steve Fawcett to make the first solo non-flight stop flight around the world in 2006. And number 2, Bell X-1. Faster than a speeding bullet, the Bell X-1 was breaking truly new ground when Chuck Yeager flew it beyond Mach 1 in 1947. Previously, any aircraft getting close to the speed of sound had encountered compressibility effects, the pilots having lost their lives in this dangerous flight regime. The X-1 proved beyond doubt the sound barrier was not a solid wall for human flight. At number 1, it has to be Lockheed's SR-71. Designed in the pre-computing era of slide rules, almost 50 years after its first flight, it still holds a record for the highest, 85,000 feet, fastest Mach 3.3 manned air-breathing aircraft. Pure awesome. It's still anyone's guess when that it might be dethroned from these titles. So, that's my X10 for this episode. What do you think? Any agreements? Anything that should have been on the list?
Oh, here we go. I've got a story about the SR-71. Apparently, it was supposed to be called the RS-71, but the president accidentally said the letters around the wrong way, and they didn't want to correct him. So apparently it became the SR-71 from the RS-71. Anyway, sorry, I digress. No, great list, Tim. Really enjoyed that, actually.
I was very fortunate actually to sit in the left-hand seat of that splendid flying boat. where it is in the museum now.
The Howard Hughes in the...
Yeah, the Spruce Goose. Yeah, they moved it, of course, up to Oregon, and... it's in a wonderful hangar they built, specially built for it, and it's a huge aircraft, quite remarkable. It was a great fun. By the way, may I make a correction? If I may, I think I said 64,000 pounds of thrust for the Vulcan, but it was 84,000 pounds against 100,000 pounds takeoff weight. So it really was quite lively.
Tony, a question. Tim mentioned slide rules. Then there's a story. There's a story about you about the flying the Vulcan and the fuel tanks. Is it 16 16 fuel tanks that it has?
14.
And the continuing changing of the centre of gravity, of course. And you used to have to use a slide rule to as part of your calculations in the cockpit. There's an amusing story about you using it to flick switches as well. But how challenging was that to fly and then continue to monitor the centre of gravity using a slide rule?
Well, it was really on the Mark 1 with more of a challenge because we didn't have an indicator. So, you had to track it with the slide rule. Though I think you could probably tell if there was a gross discrepancy, I think you could pick it up once you had the experience of flying in it regularly. But the slide rule was a good check. As you said, its best use for me was when I used to fly the X-Vulcan single-handed. And I found that I could lean over and put the pressurization on, which was on the right-hand side, even though I could just reach. And then, of course, on landing, it was quite safe because you'd open the direct vision, the DV window, to check that the pressure, the aircraft had depressurized before the before the entrance. Of course, I shouldn't tell you this story, but my wife came down to Farnborough. The first year I was at Farnborough doing rolls off the top, and she said, "I want to do that." Because they were all the secretaries were queuing up to fly in the back during the show, and so she did it in the back. And then going back to Woodford, she sat in the right-hand seat. Can you imagine what the rules? You'd be sacked straight away these days. So she sat in the right-hand seat. I said, "Don't touch anything." And again, the slide rule came into great use then to turn the pressurization on.
That's
Tony, I have to ask you a question. Was she your wife as a result of that, or before that, or after that?
Now, if I may, we met at Boscombe Down, and I took it. You know, she was the education officer at Boscombe Down. She used to cover, I think, quite a lot of the units out nearby, and that's where we met. And obviously, I took her flying in a van. I remember, if I can tell this story, I remember flying and taking a pound of vampire and blacking her out. And she was very cross. And I said, "Well, I only pulled 3G, but that somehow didn't seem a very good excuse. The rules have changed. Everything is so... The things we used to do then are absolutely incredible. I think having my wife in the right... She was the first lady right-hand seat at the time. In fact, I think... Am I holding you up now? Because
no, it's okay. You can tell us all the stories you want.
Maureen Harrison. Jim was never an early starter. He was my boss at the time, and Maureen said to Jim, "If she's going back in the right-hand seat, so am I." And so Jim reluctantly had to put Maureen in the right-hand seat. And he had a military flight system on board, which. We neither of us liked very much because it was instead of having a moving card, it was a moving pointer, a terrible device. But you got used to it, but it was awful. And so it was in the early days. And so Jim, who started late, the weather was clamping at Woodford and we didn't have ILS at the time. And how he ever managed to land with Maureen in the right-hand seat, I had visions of landing at, landing at Manchester. But as far as I know, those were the only two, Lisa Falk never flew. She flew in the aircraft, but she never flew in the right-hand seats. As I said, the accolade of that went to Margaret, my wife.
Wow. We'll move on. We'll take a quick break, and we'll come back to the get involved and feedback section of the show.
Direct Lulu and resume the Rinaldi departure and up to 7,000 feet, United 1074.
1074, climb and maintain 10,000, contact Potomac approach 118.95.
United 1074, we've got a situation with a passenger. We're going to have to return back to the airport. Right now it's not an emergency, but we'll let you know if it turns into one. United 1074 is declaring an emergency due to a passenger disturbance. He's restrained. We need to return to the airport.
United 1074, roger, remain your altitude. You can maintain 7,000. Turn left turn, heading up 190. I think nature emergency.
Left heading 190. We had a passenger becoming violent, no weapon involved. He's restrained by other passengers now, though. We don't know his mental condition, but it sounds like he's restrained for now. We just need to get on the ground.
United 1074, fly heading up 220.
Heading 220, United 1074. What runway can we expect?
United 1074, which runway were you parked, sir? United 1074, the cockpit secure? United 1074, the cockpit secure?
Cockpit is secure. Cockpit is secure is affirmative.
10,000.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
And so to the get involved and feedback section of the show. Probably our largest number of likes, retweets, downloads came through during the past month. So thank you very much, everyone, for supporting the show and helping us to get the word out there. And of course, it was all about the F-14 Tomcat Top Gun episode. A few bits of feedback, can't read them all, I'm afraid, we had so much, but a few bits just to say thank you. Jerry O'Brien said, "Hi guys, just a short note to say really enjoy your shows normally, but episode 39 was just fantastic. Keep up the great work. Kind regards, Jerry." He also left us some iTunes feedback and he said he should have done it a long time ago. Bizarrely, even though we had our greatest number of downloads, our greatest number of likes, our greatest number of shares, retweets, and so forth, we still have very few pieces of feedback on iTunes. So please do go over and help us out there. Event Fire Solutions said, "Gents, the Top Gun Tomcat episode was awesome. You helped me survive a day's painting in the front room." So glad we have our uses there. The Omega Tau podcast, of course, that's Marcus Volta. He helped us spread the word on the Tomcat episode as well. And a little bit of intelligence, look out for Omega Tau's next podcast. If you like the F4 and you like Dave Gledhill's interview earlier, I believe Marcus will be focusing on the F4. It's a technical podcast, so it should be right up everyone's street. Neil Holding said, "Just listen to the Top Gun episode. Great show with great questions asked. Thanks for the hard work." Now, Clokey74 said in episode 39, there was mention of two books about MiGs that Bio referenced but wouldn't talk about. Of course, they were Red Eagles by Steve Davis and America's Secret MiG Squadron by Gaylord Peck. So we'll put links on that, those two books in our show notes. Mehdi Azaray sent us a long note on the F-14 special. Said, "What a fantastic episode. Thoroughly loved it. Well done to the team. Fascinating stuff in Tom Cooper's book on Iranian F-14s, such as how Iranian national loan saved the Tomcat, the Tomcat's role in the 8-year-long Iraq-Iran war, and the all-time F-14 ace with 11 kills. Apparently, he says up to 159 kills were credited to Iranian Tomcats over the 8-year-long conflict. He is a very lucky man and says that he's seen two US Navy F-14s and two Iranian F-14s at the Desful air show in Iran. I'm not quite sure how he got to see those. Tim, how would he have got to see those? He doesn't tell us. Should I ask him?
By being at the air show.
Mehdi has also shared on our Twitter feed several photos of Iranian F-14s, and they too have had some of the highest number of shares we've seen since we started running our Twitter feed 3 or 4 years ago. So if you like F-14s, get over to those. We'll put links in the show notes to the book that Mehdi mentions as well. Now, Captain Brian Link, who was, of course, in episode 19, was the Osprey pilot and the UH-60 Blackhawks pilot who was designing his own aircraft, wrote to us. He has sent me a very long note to update us on the development work of, I think, what Tim described as the flying wing, the general aviation flying wing. They are well on their way to pulling this aircraft together. I've asked Brian to come back onto the show to talk to us a little bit about some of his army flying and also to tell us how the aircraft development is going at Slipstream Research. So we look forward to getting Brian back on the show. Okay, and let's play Amy's Pods Challenge.
Hi, Pete, Gareth and Tim, and everybody listening to this new episode of Extended. First of all, I'd just like to say I hope you're all well, because it's been a little while since I've managed to get a challenge recorded for you guys. So yeah, I've missed you all, but I'm back with a new challenge, or I should say question, this episode. It's in regards to Waddington International Air Show. Now, we all know that the show's not going ahead this year because of the runway refurbishment, and there's been a lot of rumours circulating that that's it now, there's going to be no more Waddington, especially not in 2016, and for many more years to come. But I personally would be quite devastated if that happened, so I'm just wondering what you guys think. For me, it's the first show me and my family go to in the year, it's our favourite show, it's the closest show to us. So yeah, what are you guys thinking about it? Would you like it to come back? Would you not be forced? What do you think? I can't wait to hear the responses, and I'll see you all in the next episode. Bye, guys.
Amy, thanks again for another interesting challenge. So it's a question this time. Waddington is an interesting one. It's been around for a long time. We know that we're not going to get an air show this year. It comes at a time when we have another budget review underway. So, yeah, there potentially is the risk that it may not come back. I suppose it goes without saying that I don't want to see another air show go off of the list. But I suppose having cancelled it this year, it's almost easy for them not to bring it back. But I've not heard that yet, so I'd like to see it come back. I think it's special. It's a bit different, Waddington, from some of the other air shows, and it's been around for such a long time. Tony, did you fly from Waddington?
Well, I told you I delivered 558 there, but I think it'd be a great shame if it doesn't come back. It's in just the right area for so many of the ex-air crew, that it really would be a great pity. And thinking again about 558, it would be. It's a great shame that this year, I don't know whether 558 will be carrying on flying, but I was looking forward this year particularly for 558 flying at Waddington. It's a great shame it's not there. Let's hopefully both events will occur next year. But the number of aircrew who live in that area is very high indeed,
and it's also a big ISR base. It's it's the RAF's ISR hub for AWACS.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But in some ways, perhaps that makes it harder to put an air display. I don't know, I don't think it. I mean, obviously they've got some very interesting aircraft there. But it's normally a superb show, and let's hope it does come back.
Yeah, hear. Amy, thank you very much for that, as always. You can find Amy at Little Red UK on Twitter and Facebook. Okay, let's move on to promoting aerospace. A few shout-outs for events pages and other programmes. Our special guests on our last episode, I Want an F-14 Tomcat, have a Twitter feed, so get over and follow them. They're at Want an F-14 Tomcat, and we'll put that link in the show notes. Paul Papadimitriou and Alex Hunter have a new podcast. Well, it's not that new, actually. I think they're up to episode 10 of the Layovers program. It's a great addition to the aviation community podcast, and it's a refreshing look at the airline, airport, and passenger experience sector, and from two very seasoned air travelers. So do have a listen to that program. They gave us a fantastic shout out a few episodes ago, so thanks a lot to Paul and Alex, and good luck with that new project. Talking of XH558, Joe Appleairs was replying to a post Gareth put up on Facebook. She mentions the Aviation Book Enthusiastic Day at the FAST Museum on the 25th of June. I believe that Dave Gledhill may well be there along with Ian Black. They're also acknowledging XS420's 50th anniversary of her first flight. I believe that's the Lightning Gate Guard they have there, isn't it, Tim? I think... XS420. Yeah, I think it is. I'm sure somebody will correct me if I'm wrong. So the Fast Museum's a great place down by Farnborough. We advertise them regularly on the show. We love supporting them, so do go down there and support them on the 25th of June. Tim, got any shout-outs?
I'd like to put a shout-out for Freedom in the Air. This is a disabled flying charity. They've just announced in the past week they've got a 2015 scholarship for a young person who may be disabled. That's 50 hours towards your PPL, dual flight instruction, in a Piper PA-28 for doing hand controls, ground school. So get over to www.freedomintheair.org find out about that. You know, great idea to get disabled people flying.
Yeah, that's a great opportunity, fantastic opportunity. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. Okay, I mentioned earlier, it's we're moving into our fourth year of producing Extended, and we thought we'd have a few little giveaways for you. Thank you for supporting the show. Our first giveaway is a flight simulator livery. Joseph Chung's been working away for the last few months on creating and launching a new airline logo scheme for FSX Flight Simulator. And following episode 32 with Derek Davis from PC Pilot magazine in September last year, set about working on one for us here at Extended. So today we can officially launch Extended Airlines, and the livery, which you can download for the Boeing 737-800. We'll put links in the show notes, but we're very, very grateful to Joseph for his hard work. We know he's been working on this for a long time for us, so thank you very much. Yeah, it's great stuff. He really has worked hard. A great listener of the show. And do know that Joe is looking for an engineering career, and he sees this sort of project as a way of developing his skills. So thank you very much. You can download the files for the extended livery directly from Joe's site, and we'll put a link in the show notes to that. So that's our first giveaway. Our second giveaway are ringtones. For those of you who've asked us about the theme tune to Extended and the possibility of creating ringtones, well, they're now available free from our webpage in both iPhone and Android formats. I have one now set as my alarm, as it takes the quiet bit of our song and then ramps up to the rocky piece. So if I fall asleep or don't get up, it certainly gets me up in time. So those are over on the website as well. We're also looking to have a few other little goodies for you to download in the coming month or two. So thank you very much to everybody who's asked us about these. They're now there for you to download. That's it. It's been a long show. We've had some fantastic guests, but we'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions, and of course liveatc.net. We brought you a flavour of various ATC feeds in this episode. Hope you liked them. Thank you very much to Amy Parkin for another Pods Challenge, and of course Tony Blackman, thank you very much for joining us today.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for asking me.
We've enjoyed it. It's a real inspiration to talk to you, to hear some of the things that you've achieved and done in your career and continue to do as well. You're a real inspiration to many of us. So thank you very much for your time.
Definitely. Thanks very much, and great to have you on the show.
And you can now find Extended on UK Podcasters. And they're at ukpodcasters.com. You can find us on stitcher.com and, of course, at iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. And please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license. Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, I'm online at RESTimR on Twitter. Or you can find me at the Royal Aeronautical Society site, and that's www.aerosociety.com.
Tony, where can we find out about you online?
Well, I've got my website. It's www.blackmanbooks.co.uk. And I also have a Twitter one.
You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk, as well as on Facebook at xtpmedia. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye all. See you next time.
And goodbye from Tony Blackman.
Goodbye. Thank you very much.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned into this frequency, Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.